Well, it's great to be here. I guess I'm going to talk half about stuff that I already wrote down. And there's a book. It's called So I'm not going to give any proofs, but you can buy the book, and please do, because you'll triple the readership. Probably if a few people buy the book, it'll triple the. Anyway, so a lot of half what I'm going to talk about is in this book, and then the other half is just stuff that I kind of experimental stuff that I haven't found proofs for yet. So I'll try to be clear when I switch. Yeah, it's called Outer Billiards on Kites, and this is the book. So. Let me explain what outer billiards is. You have a you have a convex shape in the plane, possibly a polygon, possibly not, and it's going to define a map from the outside of the plane to itself. I mean, the outside of the shape to itself. You pick a point, and there's two line segments that glance off the shape, tangent to it, so to speak, and you could just pick the one that's on the right, and then if this is your point x0, you move to the point x1 where these two distances are the same. So another way to say it is that you just take this point and you kind of rotate around this point by 180 degrees. I'll write larger in a second. So B.H. Neumann kind of introduced this in the 50s, and then Moser kind of popularized it, I guess, in the 70s. It's kind of a toy model for celestial mechanics. This is like a sun or something, and this is like the Earth going around in some way. You know, the next point would be over here, and so on. It might happen that you, at some point, you might land on one of these lines, and then it doesn't make sense to define this map. So the map isn't everywhere defined, but the map isn't defined on the complement of a finite number of segments, and then the square of the map wouldn't be defined on some additional segments because there'd be some more points that would land in those lines after one iterate, and then the whole kind of full orbit of a point would be defined except on the complement of a countable number of line segments. So it's still an almost everywhere defined dynamical system. Maybe I'll plug Sergei Tabashnikov's book called Geometry and Billiards. So Sergei, actually, I learned about this subject from his book. He has a book called Geometry and Billiards, which sort of has a chapter on this system. I'm just going to talk about, I'll talk mainly about polygons. One thing about this map is that it's a local isometry, because if you just pick a little neighborhood of this point, the line you're going to use for any point in here, it's just going to hit the same point. And so this entire circle is just going to get rotated and turned upside down. It's better to think of the square of the map, because the square of the map, first the thing is turned upside down and then it's turned back. So the square of the map is a piecewise translation of the plane. It's kind of like going from here to here, from x0 to x2, you're basically going in the same direction of this side, but twice as long. So that's what the system is. I want to show you what the thing that I find really beautiful about the subject is that, at least for polygons, let's say you had a periodic orbit of even length. So I want to just talk about the square of the map because it's nicer. If you come back, then if you pick maybe go around twice. Anyway, that was a terrible example. I wanted to pick periodic points of even length, but okay. Anyway, you've got some sequence of translations you do that gets you back to this point. And if you vary the point a little bit, you're still going to be determining the same corners of the polygon, so you'll have the same sequence of translations. So if you have one periodic point, you have infinitely many. In fact, you have an entire open set of periodic points, which means really, and if you think about it, the set of periodic points that have the same combinatorics as this one is really a convex set, because what goes wrong is that you kind of move a little bit and eventually you run into some problem where, I mean, as long as the orbit stays defined in a continuous path, that you get the same combinatorics. The only thing that goes wrong is you hit one of these places where the math isn't defined, and these are just a bunch of line segments. So what you get is a convex region. If every point was periodic, you get a tiling of the plane. Maybe I'll just show you a picture really quick. So this is a pentagon. Oops. This is a pentagon up here. Let's see. So that's one of these orbits. This has odd length, but I mean, if you go around twice, it comes back. This whole shape goes first to here, and then to here, and then to here. So these are all again, Sergei Trebashnikov studied this case in great detail for the regular pentagon. These are all periodic orbits, and you get what seems like a very you can change the colors too, if you like, so to sort of highlight the different periodic points. But anyway, this is what outer billiards looks like for the regular pentagon, and I'm highlighting some periodic orbits. So you see that some of them are kind of small, and in fact not every orbit is periodic, but there's a lot of periodic orbits. Anyway, so you get this kind of beautiful picture of the periodic points for any polygon, although people don't know much about what the picture is like. For example, one thing they don't know is almost every point contained in a periodic orbit for a polygon. That's not known. It is known that you always do have, it's a result of Chris Coulter's, that you always do have periodic orbits. So you always see some little bit of a picture like this. One really beautiful theorem is that, so here's a theorem due to many people. Something like this. It's hard to explain. Three teams of authors. I think each one was not satisfied with what the previous one did, with the proof of the previous one. But anyway, I won't state the whole theorem, but what I will say is that if the vertices are rational, so in other words, you have a polygon in the plane where all the vertices have rational coordinates, then all orbits are periodic. Their result actually, I mean, so I think this is a really beautiful result, because it means that anytime take any polygon with rational coordinates, then you get a tiling of the plane, a kind of a dynamically invariant tiling of the plane. And so you could ask questions like, how does the tiling vary with the rational, you know, with the rational coordinates? And so I thought of this as, I kind of thought that this is kind of like a Diophantine approximation problem. Like you sort of have maybe simple rational coordinates and you get a fairly simple tiling, and then you start making them more complicated and you kind of get more complicated tilings. And maybe you could understand the dynamics in general by sort of understanding how the tiles are permuted in the rational case and then taking a limit of permutations. So I did something like that in the case of certain kinds of quadrilaterals, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Really, I just wanted to understand the tiling, which I haven't done very well. So maybe a question. Maybe I'll just cut to the chase. This is the Moser Neumann question. This is kind of I don't know, maybe this is from around the, I guess Neumann asked this question and Moser kind of reiterated it later. Do there exist unbounded orbits? So, in this case, maybe I'll draw a little bit more of the pentagon. Well, maybe you can see it. There's this kind of layer of blue decagons, and then another layer of blue decagons, and then if I hit it right, there's another one. There it is. There's this kind of infinite number of layers of decagons, and the orbits are kind of trapped between these layers. This thing isn't a polygon with rational vertices, but it's covered by the theorem I wrote down. I said there was a larger class of polygons for which it worked. The regular ones are included. But this was a question for a long time, and just to use the celestial analogy, the question is, you know, could the Earth wander away from the Sun? I guess I could tell people that I figured out that the Earth could kind of wander away from the Sun if the Sun was a cube or something. But anyway, I answered this. The answer is yes. There are several answers now, and I guess the answer. You take a polygon you start with a square, and I'll just set it up exactly. Minus 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, minus 1, and then you cut this off at a, comma 0, and a is going to be a parameter. And so first, when a is 1 over the golden ratio cubed, there are unbounded orbits. And then also, in fact, this is what I did first, and then also just any a in so the better theorem is that there are unbounded orbits if and only if, for kites like this, if and only if A is irrational. So that's the main thing I want to talk about. There's a second answer. It's outside of polygonal billiards, but another answer was due to Dolgopiat. The answer is for the half disk. There's unbounded orbits, and also for any disk, if you cut it off by a chord that's close enough to a diameter, then the result has unbounded orbits. Their argument had a kind of a stability to it. So this is the result I want to talk about, and I'll say a little bit more. You get a lot more information about what the unbounded orbits are like. So I'll just try to say one more theorem, which will give you an idea that something very pretty is going on. So I'm going to call this K sub A. And then let So you have this kite. I'll draw it over here. And this is the line y equals minus 1. This is the line y equals plus 1, y equals 3, etc. So I only study orbits on these lines just because it's easier. And I'll say it this, that the dimension of the unbounded orbits on these lines is gamma 2 invariant. What does that mean? You could think of the parameter interval A. A is taking, A lies between 0 and 1. You could think of the parameter interval as part of the boundary of the hyperbolic plane. And then you could look at the 2 by 2 integer matrices which act on the hyperbolic plane by linear fractional transformations. That's the famous modular group. And you could look at the matrices congruent to the identity mod 2. That's gamma 2, the level 2 congruent subgroup. And what I'm saying is that if I have two parameters that are related by an element of gamma 2, they have the dimension of the set of unbounded orbits is the same. So in other words, so in particular, like if you look at any, in fact, if you look in any interval, the dimension can take on any value between 0 and 1, which is weird. And yet the dimension is almost everywhere constant, just because it's gamma invariant and gamma acts ergodically. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that there's something more than just the existence of unbounded orbits. There's some kind of a structure of these things. Okay, so the rest of the time, so what I want to do now is, really what I want to do is I want to show you some more pictures, but I have to tell you what I'm going to show you pictures of. And so I'm not going to prove this, but I'm going to show you enough pictures that I hope you can see that something like this must be true based on the pictures. That'll be the first half of the talk, and then I'll start talking about some new things. Okay, so all I've said so far is I defined the map. I told you a little bit about some history, very incomplete description of history, and then this kind of result about existence of unbounded orbits and the of course, if this was empty, this would be true, but this part of the theorem is it's non-empty. Okay, so so what I want to do is, if I start with a point here and I do the square of the map, I go way out, first I do the map and then I come back, maybe I go up to there. And if you think about it, if you're far away from the polygon and you look at the square of the map, you generally circulate around it. And you don't take very big steps. In fact, because you're always just moving by some vector which is just double the difference between a pair of vertices. So in particular, it's an easy check that if you start on one of these lines, you stay on these lines, and when you go up or down, you at most skip two lines. And also you circulate around. So that means that as you go around, you eventually come back. You could come back here, or you could come back here, depending on, you know, just on the parity of the situation. Anyway, so this is the first return map to this pair of rays, is what I'm trying to describe. So you start. It's a little tricky for points nearby, but certainly for points far away, you can see that you eventually come back. So I can look at this Poincaré return map. It goes like this. Who knows what it does? And I'm interested in analyzing that map. Now, in case A is a rational number, as long as you start sufficiently close to the vertex, well, since it's rational, all orbits are periodic, and so there's a little region where the same thing happens. So as long as you're sufficiently close to the origin, all the points there have the same itinerary. They do exactly the same thing. So this is kind of my favorite orbit. It's like so to speak, the orbit that's close, you know, that's as close as possible to one of the vertices. In fact, if you start anywhere else, when A is rational, there's a little interval that just moves around and eventually... 50, the furthest point out that the orbit goes is 50. So in other words, the name of the game is to show for irrational A that this thing is unbounded for a particular choice of starting point. But anyway, for 277 over 368, that's the picture. Let me show you some pretty pictures. I can take this is 169 over 408. It's a very close approximation to root 2 minus 1. You might expect it for quadratic parameters, the picture's nice. So that's what you see. This is actually, you could take this as a proof, not a proof, but sort of a strong suggestion that there's unbounded orbits, because this thing looks a lot like a fractal, and yet if you zoom into it, it's actually a curve on a square lattice. So, you know, you'd expect that if you took the parameter root 2 minus 1, you get this thing that's trying to be a fractal and yet living on an integer lattice, so it'd have to be unbounded. So this is what made me think this would work. Another fairly nice parameter is close approximations to 1 over phi cubed, which was what I did first. That's the picture you see for that example, 72 over 305. Let me take a better approximation. 305 over 192. Let's plot that. I didn't plot enough points, but so the bigger guy, the little guy, is sort of the foot of the bigger guy. You get these monsters, and maybe I'll risk going up more, one more. And again, well, you get this kind of monster, and then the smaller ones are kind of in the foot of the bigger one. So, anyway, this is another way to see that there's some kind of self-similarity going on. Okay, Nathan, you turn on the lights? So I want to say one more thing about this. Oops, group photo at 3. I want to, you know, where do you see things like gamma 2, and, you know, you might expect this is related to continued fractions in some way, so I want to say that. If you start with a fraction that's even over odd, say 2/5, then two-fifths is the, it's the fairy sum of one-half and one-third. You add the numerators and you add the denominators. And these fractions have the property that when you put them in a determinant with two-fifths, you get plus or minus one. Like, one minus five is, five minus six is one. And so on. And you could keep going, if I can, say, seven, thirds, that'll work. You get 5 over 12. So there's a kind of a sequence. You could start, if you started with 5 12. Oops. Okay. I think I set this up to work because 5 times 5 is 25 and 2 times 12. So you could think of it like this, like 5 twelfths has an ancestor, and its ancestor, I'll just pick it to be the fraction that's either odd over even or even over odd. So one of these two fractions is odd over odd, and one of them isn't. So I'll say that the ancestor to 5 twelfths is 2 fifths. And then the ancestor to 2 fifths would be 1 half. So if you have any fraction that's odd over even or even over odd, you can look at its ancestors. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to plot one of these guys, and then I'm going to plot its ancestor, and I'm going to plot these graphs I was drawing before, but now I'll plot something, I'll plot its ancestor, I'll plot its ancestor, and so on, and I'll just show you what it looks like. I'll just pick one at random, I guess. So I picked third, well, I want to get something that's sort of like about a half. Anyway, there's 158 over 215. So I plot the picture, and that's what you see. Now, this program, the ancestor of this, my program computes it automatically. It's 97 over 132. I'll plot that. And you notice this phenomenon. It's part of the bigger one. And then, now the next ancestor is 36 over 49. I'll plot that. And again, it's sort of the foot of the monster. Now I'll come down here. The next ancestor is 15 over 34. I mean, no, it's 25 over 34. Let's plot that. Oops. That's what I meant to plot. Ignore this thing going through the middle. That was just a typo. Anyway, you can see that this is what I wanted. That other thing... Okay, well, that was kind of annoying, but... Sorry. So there's several things going on. Like, there's a sequence of left feet and right feet, which kind of depends on the pivots in this construction, whether the ancestor is larger or smaller. And there's also sort of like, it's like the legs of the new monster are kind of like the toes of the larger monster. And the number of toes has got to do with sort of how well the ancestor approximates, you know, the child or something. And it depends on the ratio of these two numbers, which is essentially how continued fractions work. So you write the sequence out, and it just tells you exactly how many feet and toes there are at each stage. And you can use this together with kind of rough estimates about what these things look like to just give an exact, so to speak, formula for what the set of unbounded orbits are. You know, yeah, question, sir? Yeah, so another theorem, this curve is always embedded, and all the edges join nearest neighbors in the lattice. I don't know why that's true, but it is true.
So is there a dynamical denormalization scheme which is based on the fairy tree?
Yeah. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Nothing that I've proved, but you see some renormalization stuff in this. Okay, so the way my proof works is, I mean, I'm leaving a lot out because I want to talk about something new, is that you establish this kind of copying phenomenon I didn't actually prove this theorem that monster is actually strictly contained in this kind of very satisfying way, but I sort of proved that the bottoms of the next one are copied by the bottoms of the previous one. Like I prove enough about period copying to sort of see that this kind of and I also prove a general result about the growth. And that's enough to sort of show that the limit kind of oscillates on all scales and therefore is unbounded. So I won't talk more about that. That's all in the book. I want to sort of talk about this other phenomenon, which is kind of, so now I'll show you something new, which I haven't proved. Some of it I know how to prove, but some of it I need it for one sec. So I was interested in the orbits that lie on these lines. And you might be interested in an orbit that lies on this line, or maybe this one. And the fact is that, you know, if you start on this line, say here, there's this whole family of parallel lines where it lands on one of those. It's just a family of offsets. So you could kind of play the same game. You could draw these graphs for points on the other lines and even on the midline if you like. So sort of, I think of it as there's a kind of a temperature here, T, where T, maybe this is, T is equal to 1 and this is T is equal to 0, and sort of, you could kind of vary the temperature, so to speak, of the orbit. I mean, just a colorful way of saying it, and you could ask sort of what does the picture look like. So I'm going to draw some of the pictures for varying temperatures and show you how they change. Now, the pictures I was showing you before, I was only drawing the picture of the orbit that corresponded to a point that was closest, so to speak, closest to the vertex, but you could sort of draw everything at once. You could keep track of all the different orbits at once, and you'd get a picture that wasn't just a single polygonal curve, it would be many polygonal curves. So I want to just show you one of those first, just to sort of get you in the... So I'll pick a random parameter. This one doesn't show it. It's 108 over 931. And I'll just plot a bunch of points. That's what you get. I think I plotted too much, so just not to confuse you. So you get something like this. And the one that you know about is sort of maybe this one. And then there are these other ones. The whole thing is embedded. So now, yeah, Nathan, can you hit the light now? So this yellow line here, this is a plot that started on this line. And I can change it, like maybe now I'm going to plot things that are on this line. It's a little bit lower. Here we go. Can't really tell the difference. Okay, that was about the same. Now I'll go down again to say 4/9, and I'll plot it again. And now you're starting to see some kind of lines forming in a way. It's still just kind of hinted at. I'll go even further down, really close, maybe plot more of it. I forgot how to plot more. Should have done this. Yeah, so now you really see it. The orbits, I mean, maybe I'll plot even more. You can see more of this. So what it looks like is that the orbits are kind of following along lines. And then when they kind of come to where they meet, they kind of bend in some way. So when the temperature is nearly zero, so to speak, this kind of pattern, this kind of arithmetic view of the orbits is kind of freezing in a way. And it's sort of freezing along these lines. So that's sort of the phenomenon I want to talk about a little bit. Maybe I'll just pick another random parameter, just, you know, 79 over 230. What's that look like? Well, you see the same kind of thing, but different lines. So again, this is a picture of the first return map, but I'm thinking about it in terms of this kind of module, Z plus Z, rather than just the points in the plane. And so, one thing you might wonder is what are, you know, anyway, you can see that there's gotta be some lines here, and I want to explain, another dynamical system. That maybe I'll turn the light. So doing outer billiards on kites and looking at the first return map and then plotting this kind of picture is generating a family of curves in the plane. And now I'm going to tell you about another way to generate a family of curves in the plane. And the punchline is going to be that these two ways are essentially identical, you know, sort of quasi-isomorphic in the right sense. So this is maybe the dynamical system that you follow if you live in Toronto. If there's a lot of one-way streets. So imagine you have just a collection of oriented lines in the plane. Whoops. Yeah, they're not allowed to change. Like in Toronto. So, what's the dynamical system? You start on a point and you just move and then you're forced to turn at every intersection. So just assume there's no triple intersections. So that would be one orbit. It would just start here and it would go like that. And then maybe here, you'd start here, you'd go here and then here and then here and then here. And then here. So this would be the slopes are the same. The slopes are the same, the angles are the same, but what changes is just which lines are used. So I'm going to give you a feel for what this is like. The way this grid is constructed is that two of the I've got it so that this kind of line I'm talking about is slanted. This kind of this was the kernel of the linear transformation. So I want to use a suitable choice of alpha, a suitable choice of change of coordinates, linear change of coordinates, so that the line is horizontal. And then two families have slope 1 or minus 1. So slope. And the other ones have slope A. So that answers your question about the slopes. The slopes don't change. And they cross, I'll just simplify a little bit. They cross at integer points. The fact is that the two of the grid families cross at half integer points and the other two cross at integer points. So it's a little bit annoying, but which integer points? I want to give you a feel for how this is determined. Like, I'm plonking down lines. I've almost described this grid because I'm saying you put down these lines at integer points. All that remains to describe is which integer points do you use. So here's what you do. You take the unit circle. Now, and you take a certain rotation of the unit circle, say alpha. What alpha is depends on A. I think it's like 1 plus A over 2 is alpha. And you also take an interval, some size, and that interval has length T, where T is this temperature. So the interval goes to 0 as you go up this way and down to the whole thing, or maybe half the whole thing as you go down here. The position of the interval depends on where you start. Now, you start with this point and you iterate this map. So this is 0, alpha, 2 alpha, 3 alpha. And I plop down a line if and only if I plop down a line at point N if and only if the point is in this interval. So this is not exactly right, but it gives you a feel for what is right. What is right is that half the lines are at size, they hit integer points, and I use this interval T, and the other ones are at half integers, and instead of using an interval of size T, I use an interval of size A times T. So there's a little bit of fussing, but basically what you've got is this kind of rotation map of the circle, and then you're looking for when the points land in this rotation. This specifies the grid. You then do the traffic flow, and then the theorem, not yet proved, is that the outer billiards orbits are in kind of one-to-one correspondence with the orbits of the traffic flow up to, the big orbits are up to some kind of quasi, some perturbation which is allowed to move things by, say, 2 or 3 units. So anyway, this is all stuff I haven't proved, but I discovered it on the computer, and before the thing broke down, I gave you some demonstration of this. I don't know why it did that. Maybe I'll just try again. That was back for more punishment. Well, that's another example. You can see. I hope you can see that. I just want to do one more. Okay, there. So you see the kind of butterfly thing? The yellow. The blue is the traffic flow path, and the yellow is the outer billiards path. Okay, I guess I have 5 minutes left. In the last 5 minutes, I want to, Misha asked this question a little bit about renormalization, so I want to say something about special parameters. Like for the Penrose kite parameter, you can look at this sequence of grids. So I'm just drawing one of the grids. So you have to imagine the other four. And it turns out for this kind of thing that there's some gaps between the sizes of the, I mean, you just look at consecutive lines and look at the spacing between the lines. It turns out that there's only three kinds of spacings. So there's sort of like thin strips, medium strips, and fat strips. And I can make a new grid by putting lines down the center of all the thin strips. And I can do that for each of the four directions, and this gives me a kind of a larger grid, which is a kind of a renormalized grid. And in the case of, say, this parameter, you can do it again. Again, it's really going to be sort of a copy of this grid that's shifted a little bit and expanded, and I can then do it again. I can get an even bigger grid sort of between the thin strips of the second grid, and I can do this forever. I can get larger and larger grids. And I didn't prove this either, but I noticed that the paths you get, the traffic flow on the smallest grid family follows the traffic flow on the next one. So, and then the traffic flow on the next one follows the traffic flow on the next one. So, this is sort of another way to see that there's unbounded orbits, because you have this kind of infinite hierarchy of grids. And somehow the outer billiard orbits, it follows, some of the orbits follow, they kind of follow all this kind of hierarchy of grids, and it sort of tells you something about their structure. I hope I can show you that. So this is, yeah, Nathan, you shut the lights, I'll just do one more. That's kind of the first grid, and then this is a thin strip, and the second grid kind of goes like that. It's a little bit darker colored, and then there's the next grid like that. There's this kind of whole hierarchy. You can turn stuff off and see how they're related. The blinking lines just kind of fit between, and I'll try to do the flow. Let's see. I'll just push go and see what happens. Okay, that was the outer billiards orbit. Well, let me just plot more of it. Where's the... So... Now, if I'm lucky, I'll be able to plot the grid. Let's see. Well, I don't know if it's possible to see, but it goes along. Maybe if you squint, you can see that it kind of follows these grid lines. Yeah, I'm trying to remember how to plot this. Let's see. At some point I tinkered with this and there we go. I guess this is just to show you the multi-grids. But anyway, that's a little bit more than I wanted to say. Anyway, okay, so that's it.